Good. I can hear myself in the speaker, so I'm assuming that means everybody can hear me. My name is Connie Lynn, and I've been a system engineer or a manager of system engineers for about 25 years. Probably for about the last 7 years, I've been devoted exclusively to management. I built Groupon's site reliability engineering team, and for the last 8 years, I have also produced a food festival called the Grilled Cheese Invitational. This talk is about the lessons that I learned scaling that event from a 16-person house party to an 11,000 attendee food festival. Some of the consensus building and autonomy techniques that I learned there and elsewhere in technology, and how all this informs my approach to deployment and scaling. So this talk is mainly about culture shift and how to drive it, as well as some practical information. I do want to warn you that I am sorry, but there won't be a practical grilled cheese cooking demo. if that's what you were here for, I won't be hurt if you walk out now. So, this is how it happened at the Grilled Cheese Invitational. When I say I've been a systems engineer for 25 years, it's not strictly accurate because I have a degree in both electrical engineering and also in the fine and performing arts, two things that clearly go hand in hand. At the time that I got involved with the Grilled Cheese Invitational, I was doing a lot of theater work, mostly because I hadn't yet figured out that it's okay to relax during your time off instead of picking up a second or sometimes even a third job. I think like many of us, I tend to be driven and I can't just sit around the house doing nothing, twiddling my fingers. So I would work in systems during the day and then I would go out and build theater events at night. Being human, I like to see patterns in things, and I like to draw connections between all the various facets of my life. So we just had you can see that decline there. We just had our final Grilled Cheese Invitational after 12 long years of bread, butter, cheese, and victory. And so I was sitting around talking to some of my Groupon colleagues, and I realized that the growth of our festival is not unlike the growth that I see in operations in a lot of companies. You start out, and just like those first four data points, you'll notice that our planned attendance and venue capacity don't actually start mattering until about 4 years in, right? You start out, you're just trying to get the product out and get it over the line. You're not really worried about thinking ahead or planning ahead. Then you do start thinking about how you're going to keep the site running, and maybe you do a little bit of capacity planning, but you still have a very reactive mindset. Every problem is a surprise, and you have to handle it in the moment, right? You can see this happen a lot when companies talk, like product and marketing comes up with an idea, and they figure out how to realize it. Then they talk to the dev team, and the dev team figures out how to solve their problem, and that takes, you know, a month or two, and then the dev team goes and talks to operations and says, hey, we need you to build this out in a week and make it happen, and then something goes wrong that nobody anticipated, and you also get blockers every single time that you start up talking to a new team, right? So this becomes, and everybody sees the new teams as kind of their gate. So in about 2009, we made a sea change in our thinking, and we, instead of saying, what do we do when these problems happen? What do we do? How come dev won't do what we want? How come marketing is always telling us to do impossible things? We said, what do we do to keep problems from happening in the first place? And I don't think that it's any coincidence that that was about a year after I started running Linden Labs distributed NOC, and we ended up taking a similar approach with the NOC, where we started really trying to work together with people at the very beginning of the product development cycle, right? You had ops people talking to design people and development people and everybody trying to work together. So, anticipate demand, determine resources, develop supporting process, set expectations, plan for mistakes, and celebrate success. This is what you do every time you make a grilled cheese sandwich, right? Right. Well, the thing is that may not be what you do every time you make a grilled cheese sandwich, but when you stop and think about it, it probably is what you do when you cook a dinner for 5 people or 10 people or 15 people, and it's really what we had to start doing when we wanted to start looking at how do we get out 1,000 grilled cheese sandwiches to 200 people, right? How do we get out, you know, I think when I worked with the American Grilled Cheese Kitchen, we got out 6,000 grilled cheese sandwiches over the course of 2 days to all the festival attenders at Outside Lands, which is a big music festival up here. many of you have seen the other side of this list, right, which is when the marketing team comes to you and says, so we have a big push coming, and we're going to increase the site traffic in 3 days by tenfold. You can handle that, right? Because computers and the cloud. There's this kind of notion that everything just magically happens, right? So what I find is that because grilled cheese sandwiches are a physical, tangible product, sometimes it's a little bit easier to envision, oh, this is exactly what we have to do. This is a thing I can hang my head, my brain on. And also, frankly, everybody knows what a grilled cheese sandwich is and what grilled cheese sandwiches are and vaguely how to make them. So companies are indeed made of people. When you talk about people, it doesn't matter whether you're running a food festival, a tech company, whatever. People are just people. So my focus is about using some of these techniques to get people to accept change. But really, this is just about good management in general. If you're a manager of people, this is something that you should be doing with your teams, but also within your teams, if you're just a what we call an individual contributor, which is apparently the opposite of a manager these days. Right, think about that. If you're an individual contributor, you can talk to people and you can also use consensus building techniques, and you can say, I want more autonomy and here's how I would like to be more autonomous, and I would like to be more autonomous, and you know, let me demonstrate trust to you and all of those wonderful things. So I'm going to talk about the two flip sides of working with other human beings, namely building consensus, because people are a lot more likely to do what you want them to do if you do build consensus right at the beginning. This kind of gets back to this notion of everybody agrees that change needs to happen, but nobody agrees exactly what that change is. And then also enabling autonomy, because once you've built consensus and once you have those real trust levels, then you can have autonomy. And I think all of these are really key when you start taking a proactive, preventive approach to site stability and anticipating what's going on, rather than saying, oh goodness, there's a problem, right? That's what I say on IRC, oh dearie me, there's a problem. And everybody starts freaking out. If you've ever dealt with food bloggers or read food bloggers, most of them show up at food festivals already hungry because they skipped breakfast. They're grouchy, they're standing in line, and when you have a line of 5,000 people waiting to get into your event, it doesn't matter how quickly you actually solved that problem. The problem is that problem happened in the first place. So it's really important to anticipate these problems. Building consensus. There's two kind of approaches to building consensus that I like to use. They are, again, I really do this push-pull, yin-yang, there's two sides of things approach in my life. I find that it helps me notice when I have giant blind spots and biases, just trying to think things through from the other perspective. But this one, start in small groups, identify areas of conflict, work out the details, and the most important, write it down. It doesn't matter how many details or what you figure out. If you don't write it down, you have a problem because you won't remember it. I think a good example of this was the very first Grilled Cheese Invitational planning meeting that I went to was probably the worst meeting that I've ever been to in my life. It was the longest, it was the most tedious, because we had a laundry list of things we had to figure out. We were dealing with health permits for the first time, generators for the first time. We had actually paid a permit fee to the city instead of just holding it in an underground warehouse. So suddenly we were legit and people were hearing about us. We had to be real. So we had to figure out how to do this. We had various friends we had called in to help us out. Now we call those people committee heads. We sat down and to break the ice, Tim, our founder, came out and he said, hey, I'm thinking about adding a new category. We had three categories, which were basically plain grilled cheese sandwich, fancy grilled cheese sandwiches, and dessert grilled cheese sandwiches. And the fancy grilled cheese sandwiches had started getting fancier and fancier so that it was impossible to win in the fancy category, basically, if you did not have like an amazing, elaborate sandwich, right? So that meant that just a good, solid sandwich that wasn't white bread, yellow cheese, and butter didn't really have a good chance of winning because it wasn't competing against the plain sandwiches. So we're talking about adding in a new category. And we spent he thought it was just going to be a quick icebreaker and that people were going to just talk about it and be done with. We spent 3 hours in that meeting discussing the difference between plain, a little bit less plain, fancy, and super fancy sandwiches. And we accomplished nothing on our list. And we really, and then we were also exhausted and tired and frankly a little bit drunk at the end of the meeting. And we all forgot to write down what we had finally decided that middle category would be. And the next week at the next planning meeting, we almost had that argument again. The only reason that it stopped was somebody stood up and said, no, we're not talking about this anymore. We're going to talk about other things. So the next year, when we started the planning meeting at the Grilled Cheese Invitational, instead of inviting everybody in and saying, okay, we want to hear what everybody has to say, and everybody has an equal hand in the game, and it doesn't matter what, you know, how much you know or how long you've been with us or any of that, we sat down with all of the committee heads beforehand, and we said, what are your concerns? What went well last year? We basically did little IPMs, retros with them, and said, what are you going to do this year? Here's some of the things we are changing. What are areas of conflict that you anticipate? And we got all that information down from them. Then when we went to the big planning meeting where everybody came together to talk about what they were doing so that everybody knew what everybody else was doing, because you always have to know what everyone else is doing, we then just very quickly said, okay, here's all the heads of things, and let's break into small groups. You two get together and you talk about this area that we identified as a problem, and you talk about this area that we identified as a problem, and so on and so forth. So that's the start in small groups, identify areas of conflict, work out the details, write it down, right? There's another way of doing this, and it honestly doesn't really matter which one of these you take. The first one, I think, is really good for getting sidetracked, for avoiding getting sidetracked on minor agenda items, or if you have a large group where you feel like everybody is going to feel as if they have to weigh in, doing this starting out in small groups works out well. The other one, this next, the gathering a lot, starting with a lot of opinions, I find works out really well when you suspect that everybody is in agreement, but they just start talking to each other. And this is what we're doing at Groupon right now. And this is actually as part of one of our big stability initiatives this year. And I'm driving this initiative. We got everybody from all over the company. We have product people, we have marketing people, we have developers, and we have operations people. And we've gotten them all in a room. We actually had four different sessions to accommodate different people's times and time zones and all that sort of thing. And we said, tell us what you would do to solve our site stability problems. It may not be obvious to people from the outside, but just in the last couple of months, we've had a real rash of instability problems that we were trying to solve. And so we said, we've been telling you how to solve these problems. Why don't you tell us how you would solve these problems? So we got all those people together in a room, in several rooms, took notes, didn't judge, took notes on everything. It turns out a lot of things, it was just people didn't know we were doing it or this. Then we sent all that out for a vote, and we said, pick your top five. We ended up pulling the top 13 items, and we said, these are all areas that everybody agrees is something that we should work on, right? And already people have buy-in because they are engaged in the process. They have gotten their voice heard. They saw that their thing that they care about went out to the voting, to the entire company. Not to the entire company, sorry, but to representatives from the entire company. I don't want to lie. And now we're doing something called, we're using a couple of different collaboration techniques, and the one that we're working on right now is called collaboration contracts, where everybody talks about exactly how they want to solve this, how they think the best way to implement this process is, and then they come up with an implementation plan. I want to talk a little bit about some of these collaboration tools, right? The fist of five voting is something that we often use in meetings just to say, hey, I've belabored this point for a while now. Do I need to keep talking about it, or can we just move on, right? And it's a way of taking a vote that allows you to pull the room But it allows people to give a slightly more nuanced impression, right? If it's like, yes, I agree, please just move on. In fact, I'm super in charge, I'm super in favor of this. I'll even help you move this notion forward, right? That's really useful in a room, right? It's like, no, absolutely not, right? But usually if the majority of the room is fours or fives, you can move on. And if the majority of the room is zero through three, it means that you actually need to talk about it again. It also helps you, if you're facilitating the meeting, figure out who actually wants to do more talking. So as an example, is everybody okay if I move on to talk about collaboration contracts? I see fives and fives and fives. Do I see any no fists and no ones? And then I see a lot of decline to participate, which is a completely, completely acceptable. We're going to assume that decline to participate means acceptance, it means I will go with the majority of the group. Then right now what we're doing at Groupon is we are running collaboration contracts. And this is where, against all of these ideas that people came up with that they think will help promote site stability, right? And the collaboration contracts are a great way to form small groups when you've had people vote on things that they want. You say, great, these are the top 13 items that the company should focus on in order, as a whole, to increase site stability. So we are going to run, then we just use a Google form to let people say what role they prefer to take, right? You can take the explain role. That's a sole role that says, look, I'm going to make this decision, and I'm going to tell you everything, and I don't even really feel like I need to listen to anybody else. I'm just going to make this choice, and I'm going to explain it. That's CTOs and SVPs like to make those sorts of choices, like to take that kind of role. Then we have consult. Consult is another sole participator. It's a sole option, right? You say, I am the one. Sorry, I am the one who's going to make this decision. I will listen to all the rest of you. I'll listen to your advice people. I'll listen to your inquire people. But I don't really feel like I need to get full agreement. I'm the one who gets to make the final choice. Agree is fairly obvious. Everybody who chooses agree needs to actually agree, and they will make the decision together as a team. Advise, I will advise the decision maker. You know, you want your input to be heard, but you don't really care about actually being involved in making the final choice. And inquire. Inquire means you just want to know what happened, right? Someone tell me what happened. The interesting thing about this is when you get to the difference between explain, consult, and agree, you can't have people in each one of those categories, right? You've only got to have one person in explain or one person in consult or any number of people in agree, right? So it's really useful when you just run that. If someone says, no, I am the consult role, and you've got two people who say, no, I'm the agree role, the first step on building consensus is you have to negotiate who's going to move to advise or who's going to move down to agree. What role are you actually going to take while you're participating in your event, in your decision? And and so we use these collaboration contracts and these consensus building tools pretty often at Groupon, and we are finding that it is driving a really nice culture change in that people feel more invested, and we do have the dev teams and the marketing teams and the ops teams all working together like they actually not only care about everything, but they trust everybody a little bit more too. So to get back to that list that I had, anticipate demand and all the rest, this is the most important thing that you have to do, right? And this is an area where consensus is really important. Who are your customers? As an ops person, you probably don't really know who your customers are. You might know a little bit of analysis about how they behave, especially like in terms of their traffic patterns, what your maximum anticipated peak flow is, that sort of thing. But you don't necessarily know who your customers are, what they want. For example, when you're serving, can you get away with serving grilled cheeses of just serving a straight up grilled cheese sandwich? Or do you have to serve a grilled cheese sandwich plus one that's vegetarian and one that's got meat options? Do you have to worry about the lactose intolerant and the gluten-free people, right? These are all things that you may not know about your customers, but your marketing and sales team probably does, at least if they've got any amount of success. So who are your customers? What are their traffic patterns? Traffic patterns is something that your team actually probably, your business intelligence team probably knows a lot about. They know when people come to the site, when they don't. Your NOC engineers may actually know something about that if you still have NOC engineers, right? They know that they're like, oh yeah, no, I watch this graph every day and yep, gets big there, gets small there. I'm worried when it takes a dip there. Oh no, it always takes a big dip right when everybody gets home from school and turns on the TV, that kind of thing, right? What your max anticipated load, that's something that, again, your customers, your customer support people can tell you about, your business and marketing people can tell you about. Who do you not serve? What can you learn from similar events, right? What other launches like this have you done? What other times have you said, yes, let's do a Starbucks deal or let's do a Toys R Us deal on Black Friday, and did it tip our servers over for 8 hours or, which of course it didn't, or did it, you know, or did we actually get through it? Next step, deploy resource, determine resources. That's Tim, by the way, our founder, right? I could torture the metaphor pretty hard here. For sandwiches, infrastructure means stove, pan, spatula, bread, butter, bacon, whatever you're putting on your sandwiches. And I actually have a really horrible metaphor that involves the seven-layer OSI model. About grilled cheese infrastructure. I am not going to share that with you because it's long and involved and a little tedious. But these are things that you need to know about, right? And now we're moving sort of more into the ops and dev situation, right? What can your infrastructure handle? Can you repurpose other resources, right? Have you built up a bunch of have you got a bunch of like UAT and staging machines that you can actually just very quickly like wipe, reroll, reconfigure, and bam, you're out the door, you know, added to the load balancer, happy days. How do people access the resources? What kind of specialized knowledge do you need? How do you transfer knowledge, and how do you assess knowledge, right? This is all information maybe that you you as an ops team know, but you need to talk to your product and marketing team about this, because if you don't, they are going to simply assume that you can do the magic because you have always done the magic, right? And they need to know what the trade-offs are and what the risks are about what they're getting into. And so if you're all talking again at the beginning, this is a really important piece of conversation to have right at the outset, so that they're not surprised 6 weeks down the line when the developers have built something and then they go to the ops team and they say, or the release engineering team, and they say, push the button, and the release engineering team goes, what? Right? So one of the real big areas of specialized knowledge that I notice many tech organizations have and don't communicate out well within themselves are databases, database knowledge, and network knowledge, right? Even really large operations teams may only have one or two database specialists. Maybe they're farming it out to Percona or somebody like that. They don't have anybody that is aligned with their interests, that really cares about their product, who is a database specialist. And similarly, the networking people, right? Network engineering tends to be a very siloed area. And I know that network engineers are often very frustrated because everybody goes to the network and the network team and says, everything's slow, is there a problem with the network? And they're like, no, there's still not a problem with the network. It's just, you know, the software. So making sure that you understand, you know, how big is your input, you know, how big is your pipe coming in, how, you know, does your database take 4 hours to back up, right? What kind of offline stuff is going to happen? This is all really important. Develop supporting process. This is where you're actually talking to each other back and forth and talking about, like, all right, how do I get something into production? Do I have to am I working from a gated model, or am I working from a permissive model where everybody talks and everybody trusts and everybody agrees on things well before you ever get to the point of, is this going to launch into production? The trick to developing process, I find, is that you have to be willing to change your process, and you have to be willing to change it rapidly, right? If you've written down a process, right, and you, there's this concept that is, there's the way things are and the way things should be, right? The way things are is what you want to document the first time that you're documenting a process and the first time that you're writing things down. You also want to note in that document, this is where we'd like to get to, this is what we'd like to do, this is why we are doing it this way, and actually give people that historic context so that they're not when they're learning a process, they already know, they don't have to ask the questions of, why don't we do it this way? Why don't we try it this way? And that way, that lets them innovate because that problem has been solved. They can start thinking about new ways to do it, right? Which is super, super exciting, I find. Again, you know, these are all sort of very standard ops things to consider, but you have to, what happens when a problem is detected and what do I do in an emergency? These are things that actually the sales and marketing people care about too, right? The sales and marketing teams at Groupon in particular really want to know anytime any deal is not showing on the site, right? And anytime that deal is not showing correctly, they care and it because they're all on commission. And so if their deal isn't making it out to the world, they are actively losing money. And so they will come, and we have actually developed a mechanism, it's called the SOS beacon, for a salesperson to freak out about their deal automatically. They hit the button, they freaked out about their deal, we get it, we look, and we get a lot of telemetry in on that SOS button that they don't have to tell us about, right? They just give us the URL of what their deal is, and then we ask them some questions. And that really helps us. It makes them feel empowered, and it makes our teams feel empowered because our teams don't have to actually talk in person to the salespeople because people are scary. Salespeople, doubly or triply so. Set expectations, right? This is what that panic button does, right? It tells them, hey, we care about you. We care that you are losing money when the site is down. Sometimes they hit it and they did panic inappropriately. Most of the times they hit it because they did panic inappropriately. But they get the same response each time. We take their concerns seriously. What trade-offs happen? What safety measures are in place? One of the things that happens really often, like during a UI change, right? We get the salespeople and they panic, they freak out, they go, oh my God, my deals aren't showing, right? And the answer is, your deals are showing in a different way now. But we don't know that. Sometimes if the design team hasn't appropriately communicated that information to, hasn't appropriately communicated that information to the SRE team, either through what we call owner's manuals. A lot of people call those run books, but I find that language is really, really powerful. And so we started calling, instead of calling them run books, which implies we set up a process, you follow the process, okay, do it, you know, step by step, everybody marching, you know, in order. When you call it an owner's manual, that means that everybody, the dev team, the ops team, every person involved owns that. They look at it, it's written by the owners, it's for the owners. It's your piece of documentation, right? It's not just something that you pitch over the wall and let the knock handle. Consensus. It drives stability. You know what you need. You already know what's happened and what's supposed to happen. You've shared your best practices. You've figured out what to do in emergencies. You talk about the same things, and you talk about them using the same terms, right? One of the most overloaded terms at Groupon is operations, right? Everybody says they work for operations because the business operations team and the business information analytics operations team is very different from the platform operations team and the production operations team, right? Some are system engineers and other people are analysis city planners. I'm not even really sure what they do. So you have to be really careful that everybody is speaking the same language and talking about the same things. I think one of the really excellent examples of where consensus really helped promote stability at Groupon in particular was, I don't know if you remember, about a year and a half ago, and I apologize to any Amazon staff here, but Amazon's East Colo died a really thrashing, horrible death, and was down for, I think they were down for something like 8 hours, and that meant that everything that we had hosted in that colo was also down if we didn't have it mirrored somewhere else or backed up or something. Well, it turned out for us that apparently one of the things that we had running out of the East Colo was our Jira system. And even better, we discovered when that colo came back up that it was on an Ethereal instance. Oh boy. So the way we solved this problem was everybody got in a room and talked and said, we have to recover what's going on, right? We've got to figure out what's going on. And we scraped everybody's email, and we built a tool that scraped everybody's email and then crammed everything back into the new, not running on an Ethereal, running on bare metal, not running out somewhere, backed up regularly, and practiced restoring from backups, Jira instance. So this, I think, was, we all knew what we needed. We all were very familiar with Jira because we had used it all the time. And everybody just immediately came up with, hey, what would be the most awesome solution? Somebody else said, yeah, you know what, we can actually do that. And bam, it was solved. And this, I think, also implies the other piece, which is autonomy. People were invested in that. They were self-directed. There was no, well, Jira, that's that shitty bug tracking system that we just go to for paperwork, right? Which I've seen happen in a lot of bug tracking systems over the years if people aren't actively using them and actively engaged. But we had all agreed that Jira was how we were going to figure out what the heck we were doing. So we were invested in that, and they made their own choices. And then they drove their own excellence. Lots of people were like, we got to get all these other things back online, and we got to get all these other things back online. And they said, hey, you two guys who want to fix Jira, please fix Jira, because we want it. And they got a lot of love for that. And again, nothing is any one person's responsibility, right? It becomes shared responsibility. If the site goes down because we threw a huge amount of traffic at it, I'm so sorry, you guys. Because we threw, you know, a huge amount of traffic at the site, and so it fell over because there was so much traffic heading to the site. We look at that, and that's not just a failure on operations part for not building a robust enough site. That's a failure on the dev team's part for not getting everything building code that could stand that and would run more efficiently. And it's a failure on the marketing team's part for not warning us that we had to make sure that all that fine-tuning was in place when it would come up. Or maybe it's not a failure at all. It turns out, and here's a crazy, crazy thing, salespeople like to see us sell out sometimes, and they like to see us fail sometimes, because it turns out that that gets people excited and buzz going and makes them want to go and look at our site. So sometimes they're like, if you tell them the risks, you say, all right, you can do this crazy marketing blitz, but it's going to take the site offline for 2 hours. They go, great, Twitter will explode. Can we control when it takes the site offline? And you go, okay, this goes against everything I want to do as an ops person, but I actually kind of see your crazy point. Autonomy drives stability. Shared responsibility, comfort making the right decision. You can say, yes, we can take the site down for 2 hours because everybody's going to be happy about it. You don't wait for permission. If you see something going wrong, you already know how to solve it. And anybody can notice a bad practice and change it, right? Because you've already explained why you're making certain choices in your documentation and in your processes. Plan for mistakes. This is where autonomy and trust and consensus really, really come in. Because when the site goes offline, when you are worried about how do you revert quickly, right? If your deploys take 2 hours, your releases take 2 hours, probably that means your rollbacks take 2 hours too, right? So you look at that and you say, is that really how we want to go with things? And if everyone has agreed that that's not a mistake, that is the way we want to do things, then that's fine. I personally prefer to fail small, fail fast, and fail often, and fail with notification, because you can put all sorts of really awesome graceful degradation features into something, but what'll happen is your site will degrade, and suddenly everything's offline, and nobody knew that it was ramping up to that, right? If you have graceful degradation, but when we have something at Group One called the Relevance Engine, which drives getting deals in front of customers' faces that make them actually happy, right? That are very fine-tuned to what they actually want, and what, you know, it tracks and Big Brother and all of this stuff. That's what the Relevance Engine does, right? Is it totally analyzes everything you do online. So when the Relevance Engine breaks, we for a long time had no idea what exactly was going on, right? We wouldn't know that the Relevance Engine was down. And the Relevance Engine controls every piece of Groupon, right, to a certain extent. We wouldn't know everything was going on until something seriously down the line failed, because we didn't have good telemetry about all of those intermittent graceful degradations. We also, for a while, didn't have graceful failure for the Relevance Engine, but that was a trade-off and an error. So you can't just fail fast. You also have to fail knowledgeably and intelligently and verbally. How do you learn from errors? At Groupon, we have what we call, people call these postmortems a lot when something fails, right? How many people have postmortems or some sort of postmorteming process? Okay, we call them incident reports, because it lets us not just look at the mistakes and the errors, it lets us look at what we did right, right? We are not just looking at the death of our system. We are also looking at all the things that we did right in our system when we put it together. And this helps us foster a culture that is very responsibility-oriented without being blame-oriented. And this is another way to build consensus, to gain autonomy, to actually be happy at work, because you know that you're doing what everybody else wants. And you also know that if you screwed up, nobody's gonna turn to you and say, bam, you're fired. You messed up, you're fired. And one of the best things I learned, I loved about learning from errors, was when I worked at Linden Lab. And the ex-Lindens in the audience probably know about what I'm about to talk about. When you screwed up, if you were in a physical office, because unsurprisingly, as the makers of Second Life, we had many virtual workers, including me. If you were in a physical office and you made a boneheaded mistake that caused a production error of whatever kind, you wore the Shrek ears for the rest of the day. You picked up the Shrek ears, you put them on your head, you went around, and everybody would ask you, why are you wearing the Shrek ears? And you would explain your boneheaded problem, and they would laugh or commiserate, and very, very rarely did anybody say, wow, you are such a screw-up, how can I even work with you, right? They would often say, oh yeah, I've done something like that too, or oh, I did a thing like that too, or God, I remember the outage of Ot9, you know, and this kind of thing would happen, and it fostered this, like, we are all human, we are all making mistakes, but we all support each other, and we all really want to put out a good product and keep the site up. If you were a virtual worker, you change your IRC nick to be _Shrek. So that everybody would know, and they say what you do, and again, you would share it. And you, after you tell that story multiple times during the day, it hurts a little bit less, because other people have said, oh yeah, I made errors like that too. At Groupon, yeah, we do the incident reports. So, you know, and what do you do when something goes wrong, right? Nobody, I think we've heard this time and time again, that nobody is going to have 100% operational efficiency, right? It's simply not going to happen. So assume that something bad is going to happen and plan ahead for what you're going to do when that happens. Assume that you've overlooked something, because you probably have. The most important thing to do is to celebrate success. This is something that I think that we miss as operations people and as developers really often, because we go, that worked, let's go on to the next thing. You're very excited. You're like, yay, I did it, but I'm moving on. Why not stop for a moment and crow and say, I did things right? When we do the weekly incident reviews, the first thing that I ask people after what happened, right, in those, when I'm leading those reviews, I say, what happened? And they talk and they say all the things that they did wrong. I'll often say, so it sounds like you did X, Y, and Z right. And what systems were in place that caused these bad things to happen, right? What could we as a company have done better to support you? And everybody kind of goes, oh, okay. I've said, hi, my name's Connie Lynn and I'm an alcoholic. And now everybody just wants to tell me how to get over my crippling disease. That's a terrible analogy. but these are things that you should ask yourselves when things go wrong in production and when things break. But you should also ask these of yourself when a product launch is calm and quiet. How did we do that? And do that again the next time. Think about it systemically. One of the things that people talk about a lot is they say, oh, this was the root cause, or oh, this was the root cause. What they actually mean was this was the cause. You want to look at, the database fell over was the root cause. No, that's the cause. The root cause is what system was in place, what happened around everything to let that database fall over. What were all the dominoes that fell over in a row? Those are the root cause when you take it back to the first domino. And at the same time, you also want to do root cause analysis on your successes. And then you want to tell everybody about your successes. You want to say, we did this, we did that. Let me tell you about something that this other person did for me today. Let me tell you about this great launch. This is something that product managers are really great at doing and project managers. And that's one reason why it's really important to engage everybody, is because in the end, this is how you get to a good place. So, I have 5 minutes for questions. Yes?
So, when you talk about the bat signal for panic button, you probably have people that use that as a thing. And you said that you always respond the same way.
Mm-hmm.
How do we
stop people from continuing to abuse it? That's a good question. So the question was about the SOS button that the salespeople can hit. What do we do to keep people from abusing that sales button? Do we have people abusing it, and what do we do to keep people from abusing it? It turns out that we do not actually have that many people abusing it. And usually when they abuse it, it's a really obvious piece of abuse, right? Like, for example, I couldn't figure out how to log into the system, and this was available, so I hit it. And we sent an email to them, and their manager saying, hey, you said actually in your description of the problem that you were just hitting this button because you didn't know what else to do. This button is specifically for reporting these kinds of emergencies. That's why you have drop-downs for these kinds of emergencies. We don't appreciate you doing this, and you should know here are all the resources that you wasted by hitting the panic button in an inappropriate way. And we do have a set list of resources. It used to be that that panic button hit the SVP of engineering, and that was usually enough to stop people, because we'd say, you hit the panic button, and you woke the SVP of engineering and the CTO up. Are you sure you want to do that always? So there were serious consequences, and we do actually have at the bottom of the panic button letting people know that that does wake up the SVP of engineering and the CTO, and that usually stops people from hitting it all than the most horribly self-involved people, and those people are going to abuse whatever systems you have in place, regardless. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. I've been asked to tell everybody, rather than meeting me up here, if you could go to the open room and meet me in the open room and you want to talk to me. Also, feel free to just grab me at any point during the conference and ask me more about grilled cheese or about site reliability engineering at Groupon. Thanks.